Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we bring you our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading prepared by Jill Bevilacqua. And Joan Knows, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
After the crowds had their fill, Jesus insisted that his disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side. When he'd sent them away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray, remaining there alone as evening drew on. Meanwhile, the boat, already several hundred yards out from shore, was being tossed about in the waves raised by strong headwinds. At about 3 a.m, he came walking toward them on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and in their fear they began to cry out. Jesus hastened to reassure them. "Get hold of yourselves, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter spoke up and said, "Lord, if it is really you, tell me to come to you across the water." "Come," he said. So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water, moving toward Jesus. But when he perceived how strong the wind was, becoming frightened, he began to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me!" Jesus at once stretched out his hand and caught him. "How little faith you have," he exclaimed. "Why did you falter?" Once they had climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Those who were in the boat showed him reverence, declaring, "Beyond doubt, you are the Son of God."
The Gospel for today opens in our version with a phrase shown in brackets, which serves as an introduction. But why is it followed then by Jesus insisting that the disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side? We find the explanation in St. John's Gospel, after his account of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000.
The people, seeing this sign that he had given, said, "This really is the prophet who is come into the world." Jesus, who could see they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, escaped back to the hills by himself.
A scholar comments that although the miraculous sign has what seems at first a positive effect, this is received by Jesus with reserve. In fact, of itself, the acclamation of him as prophet and king would be a recognition of his messianic reality.
But the crowd's declaration is made in a nationalistic and socio-political perspective, which Jesus does not accept. This is why he withdraws away from the enthusiasm of the people.
Writes another.
Mark also lets it be understood that this was a critical moment. Jesus sent the disciples away, tried to escape from the crowd, and then prayed. And immediately he obliged his disciples to go up into the ship, that they might go before him over the water to Bethsaida, whilst he dismissed the people. And when he had dismissed them, he went up to the mountain to pray.
There's something of an anomaly in this account of Mark's. We know that Jesus and the disciples are already on the side of the lake near Bethsaida. And in fact, John, who was certainly there, writes,
"That evening the disciples went down to the shore of the lake and got into a boat to make for Capernaum on the other side of the lake."
Was Peter somewhat confused when he recounted this episode to Mark? It was certainly a dramatic episode, and Peter himself plays a leading part in it. But Mark does not recount this, for Peter, in his humility, does not wish to draw the attention to himself. But let's pick up where we left off. Jesus has managed to get rid of the crowds and has returned up the hill to pray. One feels he must have desperately needed the contact with his Father at this moment. No one else can do. Meanwhile, the disciples are struggling to make some headway across the lake. But the wind is against them, and by about 3 in the morning, they have still made only 3 or 4 miles. 25 or 30 furlongs, writes John. In our gospel today, we heard of several hundred yards out from shore, tossed about in the waves raised by strong headwinds. For although the fishing boat had sails, they were unable to hoist them because of the contrary wind and had to depend on their oars. From his hilltop, Jesus saw that they were battling with a heavy sea, and Mark writes,
"He could see they were worn out with rowing, and about the 4th watch of the night he came towards them, walking on the lake."
Both Matthew and Mark use the phrase, "the 4th watch," which for us is translated as "about 3 in the morning." The Hebrews divided the night into 4 watches. The first was at dusk, the second at midnight, sometimes referred to as the middle watch. The third was when the cock crows, or simply at cockcrow. The 4th, at early dawn or dawning, referred here as the morning watch. And immediately the words of the De Profundis, the 129th Psalm, come to mind.
"From the morning watch, even until night, let Israel hope in the Lord."
Or, as the more modern version has it,
"My soul is longing for the Lord, more than watchmen for daybreak. Let the watchman count on daybreak, and Israel on the Lord."
The watchman was an essential figure always, and is mentioned in yet another psalm.
"If the Lord does not watch over the city, in vain does the watchman keep vigil."
And so, in the 4th watch of the night, he went towards them, walking on the lake. And Mark, who is writing for Peter, inserts this phrase, "He was going to pass them by." What does this mean exactly? Peter is remembering that night, and perhaps that was the impression he had. And after all, we have to remember that when the disciples saw Jesus in the distance, they were terrified. If someone was walking on the water, it could only be a ghost. And this is what they cry out, in their fear, as Matthew writes, and fear works on the imagination. But Jesus doesn't leave them in that terrified state. He hastened to reassure them. "Courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." What happened next? Of the 3 evangelists who recount this episode, only Matthew adds the incident of Peter walking on the water. After quoting our Lord's words of encouragement, Mark writes simply,
"Then he got into the boat with them, and the wind dropped. They were utterly and completely dumbfounded, because they had not seen what the miracle of the loaves meant. Their minds were closed."
And a scholar comments,
"Jesus dominates the dark forces of chaos and of evil with his omnipotent control, which, however, is hidden from the eyes of the disciples, who are disturbed, but whose hearts are hardened."
Perhaps the Jerusalem Bible version, "their minds were closed," renders the idea better. And another scholar writes,
"Mark stresses the contrast between the sovereign power of Jesus and the fear of the disciples, who had not realized that it was Jesus."
In John's account, the words of Jesus are followed by this statement,
"They were for taking him into the boat, but in no time it reached the shore, at the place they were making for."
And commenting on this, our scholar writes,
"At the center of this manifestation of Jesus as Lord of being and of nothingness, the waters are the symbol of chaos, conquered by God in the creation, there is the solemn declaration, 'It is I,' which recalls the revelation of the divine name to Moses on Sinai in the burning bush, 'I am who I am.' There is also a repetition of the symbol of the sea crossed by Israel in the liberating Exodus and a reference to Psalm 77. You strode across the sea, you marched across the ocean, but your steps could not be seen. So we are shown the divine dimension of Jesus and his ability to be present among us by another way than that which is purely physical and material.
And so to the extraordinary moment which Matthew presents, when, as Sheed puts it,
Peter emerges from the anonymity of the group for the first time since the apostles were chosen. Till this moment there had been nothing in the 9 months since then to single him out from the rest.
Matthew, who was present in the boat, tells us clearly that Peter spoke up. In another version,
it was Peter who answered, Lord, if it is you, tell me to come to you across the water. And Jesus said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water.
And Piero Bargellini interprets the scene.
In that gesture, in those words, there is the whole of Peter, all the impulsiveness and at the same time the weakness of the Galilean fisherman, which make of him such a sincere, such a human figure, different from all the others. Simon Peter was a seaman, so he feared the treachery of the waves and the inconsistency of the winds. And yet, while the others trembled, he had the courage to entrust himself to a test which is inconceivable for a sailor. The sailor fights to the last inside his nutshell. His world is not the sea, it's the boat. Beyond the confines of the boat is the water, the dominion of the wave, over which he has no power. The ablest of seamen in the handling of the boat is never so presumptuous as to think he can control the sea. We have to think of this in order to understand how great was the faith of that man who lived his life on the restless waves and who asks Jesus, tell me to come to you across the water. Only by forgetting himself and the whole of his experience was he able to say this. And then the act of climbing out of the boat to walk on the water was simply madness beyond the imagination of any sailor. At that moment, Peter is outside any norm of prudence. He's beside himself. He doesn't consider whether it's advisable, appropriate, or safe. He only obeys the command of Jesus. And in doing this, he once more stands out distinctly from all the others. Paradoxically, in him, the future head of the church is proclaimed. His action, inexplicable in human terms, explains better than any other in the history of the church the conduct of his successors, which considerations of prudence, of wisdom, of diplomacy, of astuteness never fully explain. At a certain point, there's always that stepping outside the boat. In other words, the act which is beyond human justification and is only obedience to the Lord's command.
And so Peter steps out of the boat and begins to walk on the water. But then he looks down and sees the blackness of the waves and feels the violence of the wind. And as Bargellini comments,
bit by bit, the anxieties of the sailor got the better of the faith of the apostle. He began to feel his feet, his ankles, his knees entangled by the water. He was sinking.
And a few lines from a man who died in 1900 and who remains, I quote, a controversial figure as misunderstood today as he was in his own day. Oscar Wilde. His poem, E Tenebris, opens like this.
Come down, O Christ, and help me. Reach thy hand, for I am drowning in a stormier sea than Simon on thy lake of Galilee.
Wilde's Heart of Stone, runs the comment on this poem, was broken in Reading Jail, and although doubts persisted right until the very end, he was finally received into the Catholic Church on his deathbed.
My heart is as some famine-murdered land, when all good things have perished utterly, and well I know my soul in hell must lie, if I this night before God's throne should stand. Nay, peace I shall behold before the night. The feet of brass, the robe more white than flame, the wounded hands, the weary human face.
Peter, in his fear and humanity, beginning to sink, had no doubts as to who could help him, and to whom he cried out, "Lord, help me." And Bargellini concludes.
The reproof of Jesus, "Why did you doubt, O man of little faith?" is not an accusation of weak faith. It's an observation, a statement of the fact of human weakness, and emphasizes the act of great faith, when Peter, and only he, entrusted himself to God, like one who is absent-minded, abandoning the boat and separating himself, not only materially from all his companions, who stayed as they were, holding on to the bulkheads and shrouds of the boat.
And let's close with the celebrated hymn for those in peril on the sea. Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm doth bind the restless wave, who bids the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep, O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea.
And thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that programme. And now, our friend and Vatican watcher Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome bureau chief, takes us back over the past week's events here in the Vatican. Welcome once again to our studios, Joan, and let's start with our papal roundup for this last week, going back to last Sunday.
Actually, we could start with August because I think we did not mention in an earlier transmission the papal prayer intentions. Pretty important because, first of all, there used to be two intentions, a general and a missionary. With Pope Francis, we now have one intention every month, and he releases a video message on that, a very interesting intention for artists, that they help us discover the beauty of creation. And if I may, there's a big event here every year at Our Lady of the Snows, which most people know better as St. Mary Major. August 5th, it's called Our Lady of the Snows because of a great story. In the year 358 AD, John, a Roman patrician, and his wife, they couldn't have children. They'd been asking Mary for a sign as to whom they should leave their patrimony. So on the night of August 4 and 5, typically, of course, one of the hottest of the year, Mary appeared to the couple in a dream and said, build a church in her honor where snow would fall that night. So John and his wife go to tell their friend Pope Liberius about this. He had the same dream. And of course, they go out into the city, Esquiline Hill, and the snow fell exactly where the basilica is today. So it's a great story. And on August 5th every year, almost from that year, 358, there is an afternoon mass and thousands of white flower petals, symbolizing, of course, the snowfall, are released from the basilica's rooftop inside and outside, showering all the faithful who have gathered to commemorate the event. It's really remarkable. I've gone there. I've done a Facebook Live and video as these petals fall from one of the gilt panels in the ceiling. So August 5th is always a very special day here in Rome. And, of course, August 6th, This year on a Sunday is the Feast of the Transfiguration. And this year it did mark the 39th anniversary of the death of Blessed Paul VI. And Pope Francis commemorated his predecessor by going to his tomb in the grotto areas of the Basilica. And then he attended Mass celebrated by Bishop Semeraro of Albano. The Palace of Castel Gandolfo is in the Diocese of Albano, and that is precisely where Paul VI died 39 years ago. But we did have the Angelus on Sunday, naturally, and Pope Francis said, "The ascension of the disciples to Mount Tabor leads us to reflect on the importance of detaching ourselves from worldly things in order to make our way up a path to contemplate Jesus." And Francis said, "The events of the Lord's Transfiguration, which the Church celebrates today, invite us to meet Jesus and to be at the service of our brothers. This event, suggests a way to live the holidays because rest and detachment from everyday occupations can re-energize both body and spirit, deepening the spiritual path." And I guess we should talk about vacations, too, because obviously you've got a big one coming up, August 15th, the Feast of the Assumption, known in Italy as Ferragosto, which means the August holidays or vacations. And it is a way for everybody to hopefully, get away from routine, get refreshed body and soul. And so that's what the Holy Father was referring to, linking it to the Transfiguration.
It's certainly the peak, let's say, represents the peak of the summer season when Rome is at its emptiest. But it's never empty because there's lots of tourists.
Exactly. I loved it, of course, as a Vatican employee, having August 14, 15, and 16 as holidays. Not everybody, because when you think about it, we have the media and Secretary of State always have to have somebody in the various offices.
Okay, let's move on to Monday. And there was a papal message, wasn't there?
Yes. This was a message for the victims of the attack on the Catholic Church in Nigeria. At least 11 people were killed and 18 others wounded when gunmen opened fire on worshipers who had gathered Sunday at St. Philip's Catholic Church near the city of Onitsha. In the message, of course, the message was sent by Cardinal Secretary of State Parolin, who said the Pope says he's deeply saddened to learn of the loss of life and injury. The Pope extends his heartfelt condolences to the local bishop and all the faithful of the diocese, in particular the families of the deceased and those affected by the tragedy. So then Tuesday was quiet. It really has been basically a quiet week. We have the Angelus, papal messages. We have the Wednesday, as I said, the general audience. I loved this particular catechesis where the Pope still is focusing on Christian hope, and he said, "Mercy is the driving force of hope." He spoke of when Jesus forgives the sinful woman, this action causes scandal because it overturns the dominant attitude of the time. And he said, "This astonishing attitude of Jesus's to those in desperate situations, even those who have made many mistakes in life, marks our Christian identity with the stamp of mercy and gives a sure foundation to our hope." And then he said, "We who have experienced God's forgiveness should avoid the danger of forgetting that this mercy was purchased at a great price, Christ's death on the cross. He died not because he healed the sick, but because he did what only God can do, and that is to say, to forgive sins. So divine mercy transforms us and renews our hope." And then at the end of the general audience, appeals, as happens very frequently, and this particular last Wednesday, the Pope appealed for an end to, quote, every form of hatred and violence, especially those perpetrated in places of worship where the faithful gather to pray. Now, of course, he was referring to the attack we just mentioned on the Catholic Church in Nigeria. Also, he did refer to the violence against Christians in the Central African Republic. And he said, "News arrived this morning of violent homicides in the Central African Republic against the Christian community." And so then there was just a little pause, and the Holy Father invited all those present, as he does so often at the Angelus or audience. He said he invited them to think about our brothers and sisters in Nigeria and the Central African Republic, and then, of course, he led the faithful in the recitation of the Hail Mary. always moving moments that gives each one of us, you know, a time to reflect on, hey, yeah, I heard about that attack in Nigeria, but did I really pray? So that's always lovely when the Pope does that.
Indeed. Okay, so now we come on to some papal messages.
Yes, he sent a message to the Asian Youth Day, which this year took place in Indonesia. It actually ended on Sunday, but the Pope had sent a message for the final day via Cardinal Secretary of State Parolin. Now, this was the seventh Asian World Day, and the Pope said he prays the young people of Asia will listen ever more attentively to God's call and respond with faith and courage to their vocation. As they prepare for the next World Youth Day, says the message, His Holiness invites them to look to the Mother of the Lord as a model of missionary discipleship, to speak to her as they would to a mother, and to always trust in her loving intercession. And as far as I know, the eighth World Asian World Youth Day will be held in India. Then the Pope had another message, a video message, to the church in Peru. He's scheduled to travel to Chile and Peru from January 15th to the 21st. So this is a message several months, obviously, ahead of his planned visit. And among other things, the Pope talked about the wealth of human resources that characterize the past and the present of this church in this South American nation. And he spoke of and really highlighted the many great saints that have come from that nation. And he invited Peruvians to work for unity, looking to the future with hope rather than with bitterness or skepticism. A Christian always looks ahead with hope, said the Pope, because he or she always hopes to see the realization of what the Lord has promised. And then yet another message, which I didn't translate entirely, but Pope Francis sent a Latin language letter to his special envoy, whom he sent to the centenary of the birth of Blessed Oscar Romero. And that, of course, was the Cardinal Ezzati of Santiago de Chile. The celebrations actually in San Salvador, El Salvador, will take place on August 15th. So that is Tuesday of the coming week. And then in important news, not papal news, but we are all very aware of the escalating tension in the world with North Korea. And I think knowing the situation of great tension in the world over what's happening between North Korea and pretty much the rest of the world,
indeed,
the threats emanating,
the war of
nuclear
words,
weapons, war of words and everything, we have the bishops of South Korea expressing great concern over the mounting tension in the Korean peninsula and beyond over North Korea's missile and nuclear bravado. And this is a report from Vatican Radio on the bishops. They've urged their faithful to seek the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary for peace in their land in view of the upcoming solemn feast of the Assumption of the Virgin on August 15th. And Cardinal Soo Young of Seoul asked Catholics to pray the rosary in commemoration of the 100th anniversary of the Marian apparition in Fatima. And these are his words. The Virgin Mary urged us to pray the rosary for the conversion of sinners and for peace in the world, said the cardinal. The rosary is our spiritual weapon to defeat evil effectively, and it will help us overcome challenges in our faith and transfigure us to become workers for world peace.
Well, thank you once again, and same time, same place next week.
Yeah, see you after the holidays.
Okay. I was speaking there to Joan Lewis, who's EWTN's Rome Bureau Chief. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.